Russia's war is fought on many fronts, but one of the key ones is information. It could be said that between 2014 and 2022, Russia was ahead in the information war. But Ukraine has caught up and overtaken since the full-scale war began in February 22. Today, I'm speaking with Detalion, Ukraine's data battalion. Detalion is home to the largest free independent open source database of Ukraine war footage. In addition to compiling footage from across Ukrainian and Russian-occupied territories, Detalion hosts a database of verified eyewitness accounts of Russian aggression, war crimes, and acts of genocide in Ukraine. Detalion's database of Ukraine war photos and videos has been active since February 27, 2022, and includes war footage from February 24, the first day of Russia's full-scale military invasion onwards. Welcome to Silicon Curtain. All our content is also available on popular podcasting platforms like Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Please like and subscribe to help new people find our fantastic speakers. And of course, if you enjoy the content, consider supporting us by becoming a patron. We'd also be adding exclusive content there, such as chats and FAQs and extended conversations with some of our amazing guests. Natalia Mikolska is Chief Executive Officer of Detalion. Natalia is a technology visionary and expert in strategic transformation, building bridges between Ukraine and the world. She is a non-executive member of the board Ukrhydroenergo, PJSC. Natalia is also co-founder of women's empowerment platforms She Exports. She was co-founder of the Trade Plus Center at Kiev School of Economics and is a member of the supervisory board at Tech Ukraine. Between 2015 and 2018, Natalia was trade representative of Ukraine and deputy minister of economic development and trade. She helped found Detalion to help Ukraine win this war. She knows that data is power, and it is her chosen weapon in this war for her country, for the future of her children, and for global democracy. Natalia, I am so delighted to welcome you to the channel today.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I know I struggled with a few of those words there, but hopefully we can move beyond that. How did the concept of Detalion come about, and who were the key figures in developing it?
Actually, the war started. On the 24th in the morning, I was able to get out from Kyiv and to get to Western Ukraine, to my mom's. And I stayed there with my kids and some kids of my friends that I brought there. And I was helping a lot of other people that were living in Kyiv and other cities actually to find a place in Lviv to host them for a couple of hours or for a day. And actually, you know, like trying to help other people that were just like leaving their homes with the kids. But also because of my extensive international network, I was posting a lot on the social media in English about what's going on in Ukraine. And what I received, there was an amazing feedback from people because a lot of them were asking me to post more and to post more witness videos and photos. So basically what I did, I just took eyewitness videos and photos from my friends or their families or their like friends of a friends and provided the description of what's going on in Ukraine. And I was like, first I was really surprised. I mean, like, why do I have this feedback? I mean, like, why people from all over the world are asking me to post more? I mean, like, what's going on? Like, why they don't see all this on their major international channels? And, you know, I mean, like, if you are in the country in war, like, the first thing you do, it's not watch the international or, you know, foreign media outlets or TV channels. What you do, I mean, you're just trying to help and do a lot of other things. So, like, what I discovered on the day two of this full-scale Russian aggression, that an attack, that actually there is no video and almost like no video and photo coverage of the war from Ukraine. And I was like wondering why, you know, like why this is going on? Why like there are a lot of footage, you know, when you see this, the host or the major person on TV just saying, you know, like that's what's happening in Ukraine, but there is actually no photo and video on the background. So what I discovered through my contact in the media world is that there were no war correspondents at that time, because it's not only Ukraine didn't believe that the war will happen and not Ukrainians, but I think that even, you know, like the major TV outlets and the major, actually the I would say information agency, they still didn't believe that the war is happening. Otherwise, they would have sent their, you know, war correspondents to Ukraine. So basically, what we have for a couple of first days, we had a correspondence of a major international media outlet sitting and reporting from the bunkers, and basically the bunkers at that time were the spas of the major nice hotels, you know, like in downtown Kyiv, or the other cohort of journalists that actually arrived to Ukraine, they were in Western Ukraine. So one night, I think that was like on second night of the war, or I got a call from my ex-partner from US, and she was like calling me a couple of times and almost like crying. And I was like, what's going on? Like, why she's calling me? It's like 5 a.m. in the morning in you know, like in Ukraine. I mean, why she's calling me 3 times? She's like, look, you need to switch on this channel. And like, I'm switching it on. And what I see, there is this tagline, war in Ukraine. And what I'm seeing, the nice journalist with makeup on is interviewing the lady in Lviv, who is a Cats Cafe owner. And they are just speculating what this Cats Cafe owner would do in case Lviv is being bombed, how she's going to evacuate cats. So basically there is this, you know, like a tagline, like war in Ukraine. And you see very peaceful conversation between two people in a very peaceful at that time place of Ukraine. And a lot of people, you know, like I started receiving more and more calls of them saying, look, we do not see, and people like our neighbors, our friends, our business partners, they do not see what we see in your social network, you know, that what you are posting. And some of my friends from media world and people that were starting doing, you know, like something in order to tell the truth about what's going on in Ukraine, and reposting my post, they told, look, like you have to change it. Like there should be something you can do in the meantime. So all these international media outlets and major newspapers will receive access to the videos and photos that you have. And basically what I decided, I talked to a couple of them and they told me, look, if you will be able to create some type of a database within this eyewitness videos and photos and provide the brief description, I mean, where from where it's taken, you know, on which date, and just like provide the link to the source, then we potentially can use it. So, and I just like posted on my social media asking, you know, for some other people to join me. I just made a post saying, look, like there is one project on informational frontline. I need people to join. I mean, who is willing, who is available? Because I mean, like that was pretty, you know, like raw time in Ukraine. People were moving, they were like, you know, like crossing the border. So I decided, you know, like we just need to do something. So in the first day, I already have about like 10 people joining, and we started just collecting, you know, by ourselves, this photo and video. But because all my network are people, either like top level people from the business, C-level people from the business, I mean, you know, for all of us, we can do a lot of things, we can collect by ourselves. But because of our previous experience and skills, we always want to create something that actually can have bigger impact. So we decided, I mean, it's okay, you know, like to collect, but we can find like some students to do it, or some people that, you know, can do like this very simple analytical work. What we should do, we just should try to make this database very kind of easy to operate, easy to use, but we need to start spreading it to the major outlets. So then in my team, we had like a couple of people from Incom's team, So basically, it was like growing like a startup, very, very, very fast. And I think that was in like first 5 days, we got around 30 people working for us. And I actually, now when I think about that, I don't know how it all happened, but we had this database. We started sending it out to major outlets through our contacts. We made it by subscription only. So, and then actually, I mean, like we started, we got public as a project, not as a battalion, you know, but as a project that is collecting this information that is able to spread it. So the database started being used by media outlets. It was by subscription only at that time because we were not sure, I mean, how to control like Russian trolls and Russian cyber attacks. So we were doing initial verification of the people that requested access to the database. And people were using this information. But because, I mean, our major task was to collect as much data as possible and to spread the database to as many people as possible, we were actually not looking into, I mean, who is using the database for which reason. I mean, it was never our purpose, because usually in a business world, in a startup world, you need to look, I mean, like what's going on with your product. I mean, like how they are using to get some feedback. But like our goal was not about that. Our goal at that time was to spread the truth about the war in Ukraine and to show to the world the atrocities that Russia and Russian army are doing in Ukraine. And primarily we were concentrated on civil suffering, because what we wanted the world to see, that Russia is deliberately, even at the very beginning of the war, what Russia is doing is not about the military operation. It's about, from the very beginning, it was clear to us that it was about, you know, like destroying civil objects and doing a lot of things. So we were concentrated primarily on the civil on civil suffering and collecting this information and data related to civil suffering. So we were not collecting the photo and videos from the fights, you know, with the soldiers, etc. There might be, you know, like some videos and photos where you will see like some part of military operations, but it's because it involves, you know, the civil suffering. But I mean, like nobody from my team and from the people actually, and from the team that joined at the beginning, none of us had ever had the previous experience of working with media databases. Because I mean, like we had an experience of working with a lot of data. And what was great, I mean, because all of people were from the business and all of them were either in tech business, they were CFOs or COOs, people in the business that actually knew that data is the king. So, I mean, like people just honestly believe in this idea that, you know, like what we do is very important, like to send the message to the world, not only verbally, not only through statements, but actually through some very important information. But what we understood also from our contacts is that it's even on TV, if you see just like a war in Ukraine and you see that, like, you know, for example, like 10 people or including 5 kids, like have been killed. That's one thing. But the other thing is when you see here this and you see actually the footage of what has happened, people really got emotionally attached to the issue. And what is most important, they understand that actually it's people like them are in this video. So it's not the people that are living, you know, like on the other planet. But actually it's the same like human bodies, the same human souls, and people can see actually this suffering. So
how they're dressed as well. I mean, one of the images that really struck me from the early days of the war was a man whose children and wife had been viciously killed. I think it was in Bucha or Irpin. And as you say, if you just read about it, it's shocking. But if you actually see them and you see the rucksacks they're wearing, you see the nice clothes they're wearing, and you come to realize that these people are exactly the same as you, They are educated, sophisticated, kind, well-dressed, you know, normal people. And it's far more impactful, isn't it?
Yeah, and also it's very impactful for us why it was important to create this database and to show that it's not happening in one place. So it's not only in Kyiv. So if you would see even from the very beginning, you know, when we were collecting this information, we were tagging it like with the name of the city, date, etc. But we understood that we actually have to show the whole geography, you know, that it's like going on. It's a massive attack. It's a like illegal invasion. They are targeting like so many civilian objects, etc. So we're saying that also by us being able kind of to show and to collect information from different sources, you know, aggregate it. You know, we even at the beginning, we didn't even like use the word aggregated because we were not sure, I mean, like how to call us, what to do. We just call us database. And then all these words came to us because basically we were aggregating data from very different sources. But the big problem, you know, I mean, like after the first week, actually, more and more war correspondent arrived in Ukraine, but it actually have not solved the problem or the issue because there were still a lot of territories where they were not able to go to because it was either too dangerous or they were like either occupied and there were fights going on or for a lot of other reasons. But also the front line was so long that nobody could cover it. You know, I mean, like from, like with their resources that they had. So we understood that we should continue doing it in order actually to show like what's going on. And the other very important issue, I mean, like there were war correspondents, they were doing amazing job. And I'm very, you know, thankful to those that came first to Ukraine. And like not knowing, I mean, like how it's all will like turn, you know, like what happened next. And but what I see is that we started also talking to policy and decision makers all over the world. And for them, it's one thing when they read a brief on paper with like numbers, you know, I mean, so many cities, you know, has been like damaged or so many people were killed, including kids. But the other thing is when they see this brief, but they also are able to see the witness videos and photos or the photos from the aggregated photos from different journalists. And for them, it was also a discovery when we showed them that during this day, for example, Russia attacked, you know, like 20 cities and like in all over Ukraine. And then, I mean, like that's a damage cost. That's what happened. That's what people feel when they are, you know, in the city and the rocket or missile is flying. And I mean, like that's how their life changes like in an hour. So we saw that, I mean, okay, there are war correspondents. It's great. The coverage is being more and more showing the truth and showing more atrocities what's going on in Ukraine, but we have to collect the data still for a lot of reasons, and we keep doing it, and we started working on improving the database, and our ultimate goal became that we have to make the database public. We have to make it available to anybody that is interested in Ukraine and that wants actually to have access to the photo and video and want to use it for any purposes that they need. So our next stage was making the database public.
And which month did that happen in?
Like that was very interesting period in our database when it was working by subscriptions only. That was a small... Now we know that I was small and rather phishing expedition cyber attack on the database in March, in early March. me and a number of co-founders started receiving messages like to our mailboxes where we had like two tiers of authentication, like, oh, are you accessing your Facebook account from Panama, or are you accessing your, you know, your account from Cayman Islands, or is it you that, you know, please confirm. And we were like, you know, I mean, like, there's something going on. And it was within like 1 hour. So, and actually this happened when we started sending out our database to a number of parliaments all over the world and to parliamentarians all over the world. So I think that like now we know that that was not a major cyber attack, but that was rather, you know, either like to show us actually to make some threats to us, or just to show that, you know, we are watching you, you know, and but it changed the layout. We understood that we have to make the database public also in order to protect it, because if it's public, people know that there are already, you know, like some reserved copies and they can upload it. So the more uploaded copies we have of the database, like up and running in the world, the more safer the database is. So making it public also protects the database. Not only it gives us the opportunity actually to achieve our mission to spread the truth about the war in Ukraine, but it also helps us to protect what we have into a certain extent. So we launched the database like as public in March. So we did this launch in March, but because of the cyber attack and because we still were trying to rework, you know, like all the security issues and to rebuild the database to make it more, I would say, sustainable, and to make it more, I would say, proof, you know, like a bulletproof in
bulletproof,
terms of
secure, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, secure, but we call it like bulletproof, you know, because we say that like data is our weapon. So that's kind of that was the wording that we were using. We as the founders, we had to remain anonymous. So a lot of people, I mean, I've been posting a lot on my social media, but I never posted, you know, and used anything. So then the name The Talion came up. Thanks to my friend, she's an amazing, actually, brand person. She came up with this idea, because, you know, if co-founders actually are not public, you know, there should be at least a name that people can refer to. And we launched then the website, because it's like one thing when there is only a Google Drive and not everybody, because people were cautious actually about even sending requests to access the database, because where they were cautious about providing any of their data to a Ukrainian, or maybe not a Ukrainian, you know, like entity or group of people. So we decided we have to create a website so people can come and look and see like what is all about, and then they can access the database and they can use this information. So the Talion started, I mean, like we have this word, the Talion, which is data battalion. That was our thing. And but we as co-founders, we like remained anonymous, because we really wanted to rebuild the security protocols and other things to make the database, you know, more secure. So our initial interviews we were doing with our faces blurred for that reason. And that was pretty, I would say that was pretty tough period, because basically if we were, you know, like if we were to go public, it would be much easier for us to get more volunteers, to get more even, you know, potentially funding, because we were self-funded at the very beginning. But we were still, you know, trying to write, I mean, in our through our to get volunteers through our Ukrainian networks and to do it. And that's how it all worked.
And it's a perfect example, isn't it, of the power of the horizontal approach, which I think is symptomatic of many initiatives to fight disinformation, propaganda. Ukraine, tends to take a much more innovative horizontal approach. And what you're fighting is the Russian vertical of power, the Russian vertical of their sort of propaganda narratives that are then filtered from the top down. So how effective do you think your approach has been within the wider sort of digital warfare?
It's, I think that that's a very interesting question. And I don't have an answer to that because, that's the difference between a war volunteer, project startup and a real tech startup or any other product startup. Because in a product startup, you look at your efficiency, you're working on KPIs, you're trying to do that and to understand, how to change it. I think what helped us most was that we all accepted that war in Ukraine is unique. Nothing like that happened in the world for the, after the Second World War. So we all accepted that there is no examples or nothing that we can take and copy or that we can do a research, and use the best practices, etc. So we all accepted that we need to prototype and we just need to launch something to see, initial feedback. We need to test some assumptions or some theses that we had while we were planning something. And then we just quickly need to change, to adapt and to regroup. And the other very important thing, all of us were volunteers and are volunteers. It's not our full-time job. And we initially, all of us are people from the business. We really want to make a perfect product. We want to make everything. But then we stopped and we told ourselves, look, we are volunteers. First, we do not have a commercial. We do not have financial resource to do everything perfectly. Because if you have, even myself, if I have at the very beginning of war, if all of us had financial resources, but we initially send them all to the front line because it was the situation was very bad and a lot of things has, we needed to buy a lot of things. We needed to help people that were really in a bad situation. So we told ourselves that, look, we are a volunteer project. We do the best we can with the resources we can. We try to make a very, product with a good quality, it will not be perfect for a lot of reasons. And there will be a lot of issues, now and thereafter. But we just really need to be very honest with our users. And therefore, we have a lot of disclaimers and a lot of things that we tell to our users, look, that's how we collect the data. That's how we do it. Yeah. Definitely. There are a lot of things that can be done with the database, but we can do it only in this way now. And that's our way how we contribute. And we believe that what we do is important to do. And what is very important for me and what was very important for the whole team was that we understood that while the war is going on, our mission is evolving. Because everybody was asking, who is your end customer? Who is your end user? So at the beginning, our end users were media outlets and potentially decision makers. Then we understood that, they have more information and our mission evolved. And we understood that we have much wider audience, including documentaries, including people that want to do some even in media outlets, some more I would say historic coverage. Or just to do comparison, we had researchers, etc. But now our mission is actually to create the war archive of with data, which is photo, video, and eyewitness statements for a number of reasons. First, very important reason, we do not want the history to be rewritten. We know from the previous conflicts and worse, that people are tempted to rewrite the history, to say that something hasn't happened or the scale was different. Then our second goal is actually to help to create the collective memory about the things that happened in Ukraine, to show actually to be truthful. you know, so the all world knows, I mean, what happened in Ukraine and what is happening in Ukraine. And we have the same understanding based on the data, not on the speculation, you know, because I'm just like, I hate to read Twitter, you know, with this Elon Musk speculation and other major, you know, tech persons speculating about what's going on in Ukraine. I just want, quite often, I'm just like commenting and saying, look, guys, go to the Telegram. You know, when you're saying that something isn't happened, just check the data. I mean, you have the teams that can check the data, it can get your conclusion. And the third very important thing for us, we really want Russia and Russian officials to be held liable for what they've done to Ukraine, and actually to pay for that. You know, in terms of damages to Ukraine, you know, material damages, but also in terms of actually being liable for what they did. So our database, including our eyewitness database, is already working on that.
So it'll be used in war crimes trials, it'll be used in prosecution as evidence. The way you gather the data and the sort of the verification you do you think that's incredibly important? The sort of validation process you go through. I know they're quite light touch, but they must be very important for any potential future use of these materials in war crimes prosecutions.
In terms of war crimes prosecutions, we do not necessarily collect video and photo, all video and photo, to be used in the cases against Russia, because we have a more broader goal. Our goal is to aggregate photo and video from different sources for this photo and video not to disappear, because we know that people lose their phones, Telegram channels, they disappear. You know, people are losing their losing or destroying their notebooks, especially if they are being threatened. So our broader goal is to aggregate as much photo and video content as we can for the whole period of the war. So we have it. We understand that some part of it might be used as an evidences, including evidences of to show the massive scale of what Russia did. And some of it might be used actually as an evidences, some special videos and photos, especially submitted by eyewitnesses to our database. Some of our eyewitnesses are already cooperating with the organizations that are working on the cases against Russia. And we are not the organization that is working on cases against Russia. And, you know, like, I'm a trained lawyer by my background, and I know how scrutinized all the evidences are and all the people that are in the process. So we believe that those cases has to be prepared by people and teams that know how to do it, that have experience of doing it, and that also have resources to do it properly. So we cooperate with them, we help them using all the information that we have, and trying to actually, you know, to have as many cases as possible even now. We know that we might need to wait some time to get the major tribunal, and Ukraine is working on that, but there might be some cases brought against Russia and Russian officials even now. But what we're saying, that our database and our videos and photos, including our recent project, the business witness, they might be used to help to persuade, you know, decision makers all over the world that there is a need for this tribunal, that there is need for repatriations, there is need actually for not only seizing Russian assets and Russian oligarchs' assets all over the world, but there is need actually into using the money received, you know, from proceeds from sale of this asset, or using the money that have been arrested, to send it to Ukraine to cover the damages that has been done by Russia. So it's not a direct, you know, work that we are doing, but we try, you know, within our work to help those that are working on different streams, you know, to bring Russia to liability, to do what they have to do. But there is more, also more broader picture. And my broader understanding is that, I mean, in Ukraine, you know, me as Ukrainian, I would never give up until the last Russian that actually, you know, like did harm to Ukraine and to my people is held liable. So it's not a 1 year story. It's a long way to go. And I think that our database and all the information and data that we are gathering and eyewitness that we are gathering might be helpful to do, you know, like to do this. So it's very and very important, but also it's very important to form this collective understanding and memory of what has happened, and for other people to get convince other people that we need to hold liable every Russian that actually, you know, that made an order, that did something wrong, in order for people not to be tempted to do the same in future.
And you're also potentially creating a tool which could be useful in future wars. So you've innovated this technique. You've identified a need and a problem that wasn't being fulfilled by traditional media. And, you know, if we look at the history books, in the 1850s, the world's first war reporter was posting reports from Crimea. And this was a revolutionary technique in war reporting. Fast forward, you know, almost 100, well, more than 100 years. Fast forward to what you're doing now. This may well be a sort of, you know, another pivotal point in the history of recording warfare, because there's more phones that can record. There's more recording devices than have ever been present. And as you say, the scale of this war is like nothing else that's happened since the Second World War, but also the distribution channels are revolutionary. Despite Elon Musk, there is still masses of material being made available every day, millions of images via Twitter. So you've got both the revolutionary production method of images, and you've got this revolutionary distribution method, and you found a way to join them together. Do you feel that what you're doing is historic, or do you simply solving a problem in the present?
Honestly, we never thought of ourselves that we are, you know, like doing something super super innovative. You know, we always, I mean, like we are very, like, because we are people from the business, we are scrutinizing much our work and we always want to improve. Now we are working on a number of digital tools, actually digital and tech tools to be implemented and to be used in our work. But what we've discovered that all the situation with the war and actually this very tough circumstances in which we were, they pushed us to use the tools available and the tools that actually usually don't cost much for the good. So I think that's most important takeaway of all the stories for us is that you cannot say that, you know, you didn't have a resources or there are a lot of things that you can do using the tools available in order to solve this or that issue or problem. Also, I think that this war, as you told, is very different from anything that happened in the world for the last, you know, decades and years. You know, when people say to me, yes, you should look at to the other conflicts in Europe, to Yugoslavia, then you can look to Syria, etc. What I'm telling, look, first, in none of these countries we had like so many recording devices, smartphones, iPad, etc. In Syria, people didn't have an internet access, you know, like at the level that people in Ukraine have, so they could not immediately like post it or made it public, etc. Third very important issue, you know, I mean, in addition to smartphones and internet coverage and people like being able actually to make everything public. Third very important point, the front line in Ukraine is so long and large, especially when we have a missile attack. You know, I mean, like missiles attack, especially like this night, what we've experienced, it was like from very western border of Ukraine to, you know, like eastern border. So it's just massive. And you cannot record everything that happened using the like the traditional tools or using the thing that were used before. And the other thing is like the scale, because of the scale of the front line and because of the scale of these atrocities. I mean, there are so many victims and so many damaged objects, you know, like to be recorded or like to be photographed or to be, you know, like to be filmed, you know, or eyewitness statements. So it's just a massive scale that, and we really, you know, appreciate work that projects like us are doing in Ukraine, because there are projects like us that are doing just like videos, some are doing just photos, some are doing witness statements. So we cooperate with all of them. And we're saying that because of the scale, like we will not be able to cover all. What we are trying to do, we are trying to create a fundament or a base for a war archive, for multimedia war archive, so people can use our database, they can add something. And at the very beginning, we want Ukrainian nation, Ukrainian people actually to own this war archive. Because that's a part of our history.
And it could be future exhibitions. And I know you're in the UK at the moment, you're working on an exhibition, which I think, did you say, is coming to Oxford? And it's, again, these images are incredibly important, aren't they, to raise awareness and to bring to people's consciousnesses just the sheer scale of the crimes, the fact these are real, innocent people. And I think, crucially, something I want to sort of cover in a minute is how the reality that you're showing and aggregating is able to counter specific Russian propaganda narratives, which without images would be perhaps less impactful and less effective.
I agree here with you. And actually, we never thought that we would do exhibitions. I mean, it was never our goal. I mean, we don't have anybody on our team who is, you know, like professional person that did exhibitions before, you know, especially like photo and video exhibition. And it's not an art exhibition, because like there are a lot of people that did art exhibition or that some, you know, like art and exhibition that actually social impact exhibition. So when we started working with a number of Ukrainian embassies and different organizations, they told us, look, you have professional photos and videos in your database, or you have a contact with professional photographers. It just happened at the beginning that we built these relations with a lot of them, because we asked them whether they can send us some information or photos that they, you know, are not using for their, you know, like professional work or for their media outlets that they are working on. So people started talking to us, look, you know, like there will be this major voting in US Congress next, you know, week. What we can do, we just need to show them the scale of atrocities so people, you know, understand like what's going on in Ukraine. So we organized an exhibition with bipartisan support in Rotunda, in US Congress building, and the exhibition was just showcasing like what's going on in Ukraine, and it was showcased a day before this very important voting. Then we repeated it. Then we received requests from different organizations saying, look, you know, like, can we use your images or the images that you have from professional photographers for our purposes, you know, like to have these exhibitions within the framework of our event. So basically, when people have a coffee, you know, or they're going through registration, they already see the images of all these atrocities of what's going on in Ukraine. And it's very powerful. It's very, very powerful, because people stop, people read when it happened. Some of them got interested and they can go and check, you know, what happened on this day exactly in this place. And we just, you know, like this new stream or new kind of a product arrived and was created within our work on advocacy, because that's a part of the thing. We understood that we have these powerful tools that we can use. And on Monday on Ukraine conference in Oxford, again within the framework of the conference that deals with a lot of issues, including bringing Russia to responsibility, to economic issues, to other issues, military issues, people will just have to see these images of what has happened to Ukraine. Because if we're saying that people have seen everything, no. And that's and sometimes you just need to remind people that it's going on, and to show some recent images and to show some recent videos of what is happening. And you know, like, I never believed, like, I never thought of that before in my life, you know, because I'm, again, as a person that worked in the government, that worked in the private business and was doing a lot of government relations work, usually, I mean, like, I'm operating with the data, like numbers, you know, like results, what it will bring, what we can have, like, you know, how it can help. But the war, it's not only about numbers. The war, it's about destroyed lives. The war, it's about, you know, I mean, destroyed, not even houses, not even the civilian object. War, it's like the most awful thing that could happen to anybody in his or her life. So it's more about that and showing the implications of the war for ordinary Ukrainians, for people, for civilians.
And of course, people taking these images, recording these images from occupied territories, territories occupied by Russians, they're taking a tremendous risk, aren't they? And you've been collecting images not just from, Ukrainian territories, but from those Ukrainian areas occupied by the Russian forces. And one of the tragic things as well, isn't it, is that through the filtration process, through the process of interrogating people, stopping them, searching them, looking at their phones, the huge risk people have taken to record these images and videos to protect their own safety, many have had to destroy their phones or delete their archives that they really took those risks to take. So you're not just aggregating, you're also preserving a record of what's gone on, especially in primarily Russian-speaking areas. I mean, this is the horrific irony of Russia's invasion to protect Russian speakers. They're, you know, bearing some of the worst part of this war, places like Mariupol, Dnipro, Kherson, and others. That's an incredibly important part of your work, isn't it? Preserving their experiences and images and videos for the future.
What we are trying to do, we are trying to preserve as many images as possible, including images from what we call official sources, from the website of local authorities and from the government of Ukraine. Because even, you know, like with them, with their official images, I mean, it's still, you know, we don't know where they are stored. We do not know like what could happen with a potential like cyber attack or any other thing. So we are trying to aggregate information from as many sources as possible, including sources from potentially occupied territories. With this video, you know, we have a category, we called it unverified video. So that's like coming back to your issue about verification. So quite often we are not able, or we do not want to verify videos that we have from occupied territories for the security reasons. Because if we will verify it, we might put a person that actually filmed or did this photo and video at risk, even if this person is not already in the occupied territory. Because usually, I mean, like we received all this photo, I mean, these photos and videos are published quite often when the person just, you know, left the occupied territory. But quite often those people, they have relatives, they have friends there, so they are still, you know, at risk for what they are doing. Or they potentially might need to go there, to go back there. So it's all very, very sensitive. And I think that we really need to think about not creating for anybody any additional problems or potentially risks that they already have. And it's very tricky issue, and it's some kind of a like researcher's dilemma, whether you want to dig deeper. And but we, from the very beginning, we decided that we do not do it. We do not do the verification of the eyewitness photos and videos, because like you need to have a lot of resources to do that. There are special techniques, and people are verifying these photos and videos for certain purposes, including purposes to be used in the cases against Russia. And those people are working on these cases, they know how to do it, and that's it. So we might, you know, what we do if we are requested like to do, to provide some potentially some verified photos and videos, we are using our networks of eyewitnesses, and through them we are obtaining photo and video for potential, you know, through their networks, to for potential cases, or for, you know, potentially if somebody is doing a documentary about Ukraine and about certain episode of the war, we are using our network to get this verified, you know, eyewitness photo and video for certain purposes. But that's unfortunately how it is. And I mean, like, the war is going on, it's a year already. And we understand then when, I'm not using the word if, but when the war is over, we still will have a lot of work to do, because more and more videos and photos will be discovered. People that are afraid, you know, to release some of the videos and photos will be releasing them. There will be a lot of photos and videos from the occupied territories. And I think that, I mean, the scale is just like, you know, all this is tragic, and the scale of the territory damaged, of the villages damaged, it's just unbelievable. So that was going to be a lot of work.
That was going to be my next question, really, is where Detalion goes next. But it's clear from what you've just said that there is years of work still to do to gather all the war images. But also, once Ukraine starts rebuilding, there's going to be very positive images potentially of reconstruction that could also be used to engage with Western partners and get support for that reconstruction. And then in the decades to come, this will become an extremely important archive. So I think that sort of lays out the future. Is there anything that you can add to that about the future of Detalion? And also, my last question there was also going to be, how can people watching this help? You know, whether they're journalists or members of the public, or, you know, NAFO army, how can people use your, use your images and resource to help support Ukraine and the work you're doing?
I mean, my ideal picture, an ideal picture of our core team, is that we have to make the database sustainable, to make and to create all the processes in the way that we collect as much data as possible, verify it as much as we can, and do it in the way that it can be used actually for different purposes. But in our ideal world, we hope that one day some institution would emerge that would do it properly. So the proper war archive or an institute of war. You know, notwithstanding whether it's public or private, I more believe in the private institution, because I mean, our government will have a lot of work to do with rebuild, and you mentioned that. So as soon as we have this institution, and we are now talking to a number of organizations in Ukraine about potentially like creating it and uniting all our efforts to do it, we want to transfer all that we have, including maybe potentially some team members that would like to do it professionally, to this institution, to make it, you know, like the proper archive, and to work with all the data and everything properly, because I believe that it has to be done, you know, by professional team and by professional people. But in the meantime, I understand that we still need to collect this data, and we are now trying to convert our team into mixed model by hiring some core team members to do this as a professional work. 24/7 because we just need to do it. And the scale of our project, I mean, we are pretty big, I would say. And there are a lot of administrative work. There are a lot of work related to database collection, etc. So that's our plan, to have some core team, professional core team members plus volunteers working, you know, like side by side. And volunteers contributing, because we still believe in the power of volunteering. Unfortunately, Ukrainians are being exhausted because it's a year of war. They exhausted emotionally, they exhausted financially, and they are all over the world. I mean, their families are splitted, and we see it from our volunteers. We see that people, a lot of people, love the project because they just emotionally couldn't do it. It's very difficult emotional work. And some people left because they needed to concentrate on actually earning money and taking care, you know, financially of their family. Some people left because they had to look after their, you know, elderly parents that are like not going through their best times in their life. We have some people that joined because they already, you know, they were working in some other volunteers project, like supplying some, working on buying some vests or helmets. And now it's more or less kind of, we have it provided by our government and foreign partners. So they just came to our project. So we're saying that we just really need to work on making the project sustainable. And what we are doing now, we are fundraising, because as of today, we are being self-funded or funded by donations of our friends and family and people that really value what we are doing. We had a couple of people that actually used images and photos from our database, and they just, you know, like, we're not taking any money, but they just donated with a thank you note that I use it for my research, and that's kind of my contribution to what you are doing. We were able to won some grants to the talent, very small one, but because the talent was never created as an, you know, like organization to receive grants, we are all mission driven. We are usually concentrating on developing the database and developing all the processes than submitting grants, but maybe that's what we need to think about, to do, to work and concentrate more. So your question was how people can help. First and the most easiest way is just to share information about our database in your social media, or to send it to the people that you think that might be interested in actually materials and in the data that we have.
And if people use the images, you know, if they use the images in memes, if they post the images, then they really should reference your organization, and they should put a link back to the website.
Yes. And if they, people could, you know, they like what we do, if they can like spread the word about us or help us with fundraising, we have a PayPal. We also have a nice charity collection done by the Aspinall of London, where people can buy a nice Ukraine-related present, which is the keyring in the colors of Ukrainian heart, keyring in the colors of Ukrainian flag. They can buy a nice present, and proceeds out of this purchase would go to the talent. And that's an amazing, you know, example how actually businesses can support us. It's also about, you know, launching some charity drop and providing proceeds to the talent. The other important thing that people can do, I do a lot of public speaking. So I am ready to come to your company to tell about like what's going on in Ukraine, to talk about our story and our journey, and to talk more about like our experience and our team and what we do. I mean, how, you know, like our ways of innovating and our ways of a bit disrupting the landscape. I'm very hesitant to using the word market, etc., but I now call it landscape. So I'm ready to come and to talk to you, and then to use, you know, the proceeds of my talk for funding the talent. So that's what I'm doing quite a lot in the UK. And I'm really thankful, you know, to all the people in the UK that are supporting Ukraine and supporting us, because the level of support here is amazing. And I've never heard no if I asked anybody for help. You know, either it's related to the talent or to Ukraine or helping other Ukrainians here. So it's amazing. It's very encouraging. And every, you know, like support and help and your good words in public, they also provide a energy to our team to keep running, because it's very important to hear feedback. It's very important to hear that people really like and use what we do, and that they are ready to support us, you know, with a small donation. Even a small donation matters for our work now.
And it's incredibly important work. I know we're run out of time there, but this is incredibly important work. I really encourage people to check out your database, check out the images, and actually start engaging with the images, using the images to combat war fatigue, which can set in, because images make things so much more relevant, so much more immediate to people, and they trigger an emotional response. So I think the work you're doing is extraordinarily important. And of course, Russia's terrorist propaganda narratives never cease. Even when Ukraine is victorious, that doesn't mean the propaganda war is going to be over either. So again, this material is incredibly important to really, you know, counter Russian aggression. And I'm so grateful to you on your trips. I know you've got so much to do with the conference coming up and with the exhibition. I'm so grateful that you've spent this hour talking to us today, Natalia. And of course, quite a lot of preparation went into this interview. So yeah, incredibly grateful to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for supporting Ukraine.